Well, I hope you've all gained something out of this morning's session, as I certainly have. So our next guest speaker is Marion Kickett. Marion is a Noongar woman from the Ballardong language group. She was born in the wheatbelt town of York. Marion spent the first 10 years of her life on the York Reserve, surrounded by her grandparents, uncles, aunties and many cousins. She completed all of her schooling at York and left to pursue a career in nursing. However, always returned home to visit the family. After nursing for some years, Marion saw the importance of education and decided to become an educator herself. During this time, she completed a health science degree, majoring in Aboriginal health and community development with honours, and is currently close to completing her PhD. Marion has worked as an educator both at community and at tertiary level for the past 18 years. Her research interests include Aboriginal health and wellbeing, healing, cultural education and awareness, and family history. From a young age, Marion has been involved in developing, implementing and evaluating cultural awareness programs and workshops. In recent years, she has become more involved in healing and family history. She has worked with the curator of the York Residency Museum in adding more information about the local Ballardong Noongar history from her family's perspective. So please welcome Marion Kickett.
Thank you. So I was asked to come and speak about my PhD and the results. I've presented this number of times now, and it seems every time I seem to present it, I get asked to come and present somewhere else. So some of you may have heard it, most of you may not have. But the question that I actually asked for my thesis, or the research question, was what makes a successful Aboriginal person resilient? And it's a question that has been changed a bit, but that's what I ended up with. So why did I choose such a topic? Why a question such as that? And I guess it goes way back when I first started my first job, I think, and it wasn't nursing, it was working in a shop at the back as a machinist. And I remember the person that was teaching me, she kept saying, "I don't understand, you know, why you?" And I didn't really get what she meant, but I think she was talking about other Aboriginal people around. Why are they not here like you? Why are you here? What is different? And I really couldn't answer her question, as I couldn't answer the question by many others that I'd come across. Even when I started nursing, the question was put to me. Why do some Aboriginal people, why are they so successful and others are not? So the first thing I had to decide was, what is a successful Aboriginal person? Because I thought, well, they keep looking at me, so obviously they think I'm successful. So it had something to do with work. It had something to do with, you know, turning up and doing all the things that I was doing. Because some Aboriginal people I worked with, they'd last for a small amount of time. Same when I did my nursing training. There were some that started, never ever finished. And there was lots of reasons around why that happened. But I couldn't answer these questions in just 5 minutes. So I decided to do a PhD and answer the question. So when I thought about who was successful, but then I said, well, who should define it? I didn't feel that I had the right to define what a successful Aboriginal person was. So I thought, you know, you have to look at success. What does that mean? And where is it coming from? Because, you know, there's lots of Aboriginal people who I consider are very successful. You know, the grandmother who is raising her 5 or 6 grandchildren is a very successful Aboriginal person. The Aboriginal artist who sits probably somewhere out in a remote community doing his or her beautiful art is a very successful Aboriginal person. So I looked at myself and I thought, well, I'm going to go and ask my elders. So I decided to ask my Aboriginal elders. This was family elders who, you know, I'd grown up with, who knew me very well. And of course, I'd known them all my life. Some of them I'd met later, but it was important what they said to me. I thought, you know, they would be the ones to define what a successful Aboriginal person is. And this is what they came up with. They said, first of all, someone who identifies as an Aboriginal person, because there's many Aboriginal people and they are Aboriginal, but they don't tend to identify as an Aboriginal person. And over my life, or my working life, I've met quite a few, and I understand why they didn't identify, because they didn't have to, and they could probably get away with it more so than me with my appearance, and especially a name like Kickett, you just can't say you're not Aboriginal. So they said someone who identifies as an Aboriginal person openly and willingly, someone who is accepted and respected by the Aboriginal community. And this is also a very important point. And the more I present this presentation, something that came to me afterwards, you know, it's accepted as an Aboriginal person. It's also your family. It's not just you, it's your family. So you've got to be respected by the community. And it's someone who adheres to cultural responsibilities. So you can't just say you're Aboriginal and not do the cultural thing, so to speak. So we all have cultural responsibilities in our families, within our communities, and even in, you know, in our workplaces. So this is what they actually said to me. These are the things that make a successful Aboriginal person, or they make an Aboriginal person successful. So I took this information away, and then I thought, well, how do I select my participants? Because I had to do some interviews, and I want to do individual interviews, but how do I choose the people? And so that was something I researched, and I found this was also a part of yarning, which I've come to discover as well. When I was yarning to people, I would ask them to tell me, you know, who they thought would be good or would, you know, want to be interviewed by me or would allow me to interview them. And yeah, and so I needed to select people who worked and studied for a period of 10 years. That was one of my criteria. And I had the age group of 25 to 60 years plus. So it was a wide age group, and I wanted that. I wanted a good number of people in those to represent those areas. And I wanted to do people from all over Australia as well. So that was another task. But this snowballing, I read it and I thought, oh, that's a snowball sampling. And it was in, you know, the research books, and it was definitely a way of selecting people. But my way was thinking, oh, well, you just go out and yarn with people and they'll tell you. So in an Aboriginal context, it was yarning. But snowball sampling was in the research textbooks. So I thought I'd better put that down. However, the next thing was the method. And I had lots of issues with this method because, you know, my supervisor and other people that I spoke to said, well, you know, what methods are you going to use? You know, and they showed me how to write questionnaires. They showed me how to, you know, do all sorts of things to try and get the information. And I wasn't happy with any of them. And I thought, oh, no, this isn't going to work because I've been involved with this. And Noongar people or any Aboriginal person, they'll just tell you what they want you to know to get rid of you. And I'd heard it said over and over. You know, if it's not done correctly or properly, you know, people just quickly fill out a questionnaire and they write anything. So I really looked at the method and I thought, no, I've got to use something that I've used all my life, that I've done all my life. And as an Aboriginal person, I chose yarning because that's what we do. We yarn. We sit down and have a conversation and we call it having a yarn. So I chose the method of yarning. And something else which I again thought I'd better, you know, do a bit of giving and taking. So I took from, you know, the research something called lifelines, and this was documented. So I pulled the lifelines out, which I'll explain in a minute what that is. But yarning, and I needed to find something that was written about yarning. And I couldn't find anything. And of course, when you're doing research, this is absolutely terrible because you've got to find something about it, documented in research. It's got to be there. and no one had really written about it. And so I just kept going, and I thought, well, something will happen. You know, it'll all come good. And then there was a paper written by Dawn Bezerra last year. She published it, thank goodness. And she had the types of yarning. So I was able to reference Dawn's paper. And I think I referenced a couple of autobiographies where people spoke about yarning. But with Dawn, she, in her paper, wrote about four types of yarning. She said there's social yarning, research yarning, collaborative yarning, and therapeutic yarning. And these were the types of yarning that she spoke of in her paper, so I could reference it. However, I didn't really use the research yarning. Because with the research yarning, you were always thinking about your question. And when you were yarning with people, in Dawn's paper, she did this. She said that she kept thinking and interrupting people when they were yarning. And, of course, I felt really happy because she'd made the same mistake I made. But I didn't make it in my research. I made it when I was talking to the elders because I had that question in my mind and I kept interrupting a couple. Well, I only did it to a couple. And I got pulled back or put back in my box, so to speak. As one old auntie says, look, do you want to listen to us tell our story or what? And I said, oh, no, I do want to listen. And she says, well, stop interrupting. So I learnt very early on not to interrupt, just to let the story be told. And I knew that that was the way we had to do it because I've done it all my life. But as a researcher, you kind of get a bit testy, I guess, when you want the information, you know, that you need for your research. So I learnt that before actually doing my research, which was a good thing. So I actually did the social yarning, the collaborative yarning and the therapeutic yarning that Dawn speaks about. So she talks about social yarning. It's an unstructured way of yarning. It follows a meandering or around and round the mulberry bush. Aboriginal people talk and they tell you what's wrong with them if you've been a nurse or you've been a doctor and you are trying to get information from them. They tell you their story and it's in a meandering way or around and around the mulberry bush. And it's guided by the topic that both individuals choose. Collaborative yarning is centred around sharing information about similar topic. So it's used to confirm an understanding of the concept of resilience. So a lot of people that I talked to, they didn't really understand what the word meant. What does resilience mean? So I use this type of yarning to get them to understand what exactly was resilience and what it meant. Therapeutic yarning was the most common yarning I used. It relays information that is traumatic or intensely personal or emotional. And so many people that I interviewed had a very, very sad story to tell, although they were very resilient people. They told me their stories, which was quite generous of them. And I found in using the yarning method, it was really the only way that they came out with such rich, rich information. And this really made my research as it is now. And of course, I mentioned about research yarning, structured around a research interview, gathering information throughout the story. So I couldn't use this at all with my interviews because I'd learned the lesson from the elders. So the participants in this research study were asked to share their story. And that's all I did. I said, tell me your story. There were no structured questions. The questions that were asked by the researcher were to clarify certain points made during the yarning process. So I clarified as they were talking to me. The majority of participants' stories were intensely personal and for many very emotional. All participants stated that the process was healing for them. They felt quite healed after they got it out. So it was very healing for them to tell their story. Some commented that no one had ever asked them to share their story and then sit and listen. So they'd been asked, but nobody really sat and let them talk, just sat there and listened. So that's what I found also, something that came out of my research, just sitting and listening to people's story. I mentioned lifelines as the other method, and this worked quite well with the yarning. So it's Woodhouse's lifelines, And it's where participants are assisted in recalling events pertinent to the study's research question. And they use lifelines. So what I got them to do was to do a lifeline exercise. And they had to draw a line on a piece of paper and they had to record on that line significant events in their life that relates positively or negatively to the study's focus. So lifelines provide more time for thought. So this did really work. As they were yarning to me, I could see that they'd look back to their line, their little picture, and then they'd have a trigger, they'd see something, then they'd go on to that topic. So it did help them, I guess, try and stay on track. And if they didn't and they couldn't remember, I'd say, oh, what about we go back here? So they'd look back to their little piece of paper and they'd get back to what they were talking about with their story. And it did work very well with yarning for this research. So that's what people did. They did the lifelines to help them. So when I started doing this research, I had to look for different definitions. I had to find some definitions of what resilience really is. What is resilience? And to begin with, I didn't really like the word because I saw resilience as quite an individual thing. You know, you're an individual. And, you know, with Aboriginal people, it's not always about individuals. It's very much about, you know, all of us, our community, our family, especially our family, and then our community. So I didn't really like the word resilience, but I went and looked it up. And there's a whole lot of different meanings, depending on which ones, you know, you'd like to hear or which ones you ever want to use. So it's a human capacity to face, overcome, and even be strengthened by experience of adversity. The human capacity to deal with, overcome, learn from, or even be transformed by the inevitable adversaries of life. And the ability to withstand and rebound from life challenges, strengthened and more resourceful, are the three I chose to put up today. So the first thing that I had to find out when I looked at these different definitions, and I honestly looked at more definitions than this. I certainly did do my research on resilience. So first thing I had to look at, what were the adversities and challenges for Aboriginal people? And that was something I needed to answer. I had to find out what were the adversities, what challenged Aboriginal people? And this is what came out of my research. When I looked at my butcher's paper, and there was so much butcher's paper, the stories and stories, and I had all my themes, these are the two things that most people spoke about. And it was the colonial experience, I'd put them under that. They might have spoken about something, but it came under that heading, the colonial experience. And other things they mentioned was racism. So these were the two things that came out. And I remember going to one participant's place, and I didn't know this lady, she was told to me by one of her relatives. And I rang her up and made an appointment. And I thought she was quite specific about the time I got there and the day. And she said, please don't come before, you know, 3 o'clock. Come after that. So I made sure I got there about 3:30. And of course, when she opened the door, I you know, having a nursing background, I knew straight away, I thought, oh, you're having treatment. She says, yes, I'm having chemo. And she says, I just had to tell you to come after because before that I just vomit and vomit. And she says, I'm just no use to anybody. And, you know, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, here's a very resilient Aboriginal woman. So she invited me into her unit and I went in and I started the interview and she told me the most amazing story. She was of the Stolen Generation. And told me everything that, you know, she just poured her life out. And again, like many others, oh, she says, I feel really good. You know, that was really, really healing. It was good to get that all out again. And I had to say to her once, you know, I said, so what, you know, what are the challenges then? And she said, well, I told you the story. And I said, well, in the story you never mentioned your cancer. Isn't having cancer an adversity? Or it's a challenge? And she said, it's a walk in the park compared to the racism I've suffered. And that kind of hit home to me, you know, exactly what these adversities were to many of the people that I had spoken to. So she didn't really see cancer as a major challenge with what she'd been through in her life. So after doing the interviews, I thought, well, I must look at resilience from an Aboriginal perspective. I looked at all the definitions, and they're all from non-Aboriginal perspectives. I needed to say, well, okay, we need to come up with a definition from an Aboriginal perspective. And I again went back to the elders and talked to them about this. Of course, those that were still with me. And then this is the definition that we came up with after all the results came in. Resilience is the ability to have a connection and belonging to one's land, family and culture, therefore an identity. Resilience allows the pain and suffering caused from adversities to heal. Resilience is a strong spirit that confronts and conquers racism and oppression, strengthening the spirit. It is the ability not to just survive, but to thrive in today's dominant culture. And that was the definition that I came up with from all of these transcripts and also talking to the elders as well. These are the themes that came out of my transcripts. The number one reason why people who I interviewed, and because they're all resilient people, all of them were working for 10 years and more, or combined studying and working for 10 years. And the number one theme that every single person said that made them a resilient Aboriginal person was their family. That was the number one. Identity came second, culture third, and then from there on it just went down, with many people saying all of these things made them resilient. I was kind of disappointed that health came last. So most people, or all people, thought health wasn't really on the top of their list to make them resilient. There were a few people that said, yeah, well, you know, to be healthy you can be a bit more resilient. But to get them to where they were, they said all of these other themes. And they were the themes that I pulled out of those transcripts. So I went home and I had to do a resilient framework. My supervisor said, I need a framework. And I thought, what's a framework? How do you get a framework? So I sat down with my brother, who was having a couple of beers. And he always does his best thinking when he's had a couple. And he reminded me of a story that was told to us when we were kids. Because I was telling him about my research and I was telling him about what came out, as you do. You're constantly talking about it. And he said, well, that's just what Dad said. And I couldn't work out what he said. And then I remember the story and I found it. It took me a weekend and a whole week to find it out of the garage and pull it out of boxes that I'd had packed away. And this is the story that I wrote down when I was a child from my father. And it's a dreaming story about the Willy Willy. He says, the Willy Willy is an old fella that comes on a hot day, swirling round and round. Up he goes, up and up, right off the ground. He uses a hot, strong wind to gather everything up, whatever's in his way, and carries it up and up, right up in the air. The bad things, well, he lets these go. He lets them go along the way, but he keeps them good things. Yep, he keeps the good, and he carries them somewhere over there. Then, well, he gets tired. Yeah, that old fella, he's tired now. So he drops all them good things. He got right back on the ground. See, he can come back for them, good things, because they're his. They belong to him, and he keeps them. We've got to be like that old fella, you and me. Yeah, we've got to be like that old fella. We've got to keep all the good things, keep all the good things inside us. Our family, our people, our land, our dreaming and our stories. We've got to hold on to them because they are the good things. Now that old fella, he let the bad things go. He just let them go. See, that's what we've got to do. Let the bad things go. Don't stay angry with fellas, let it go. Don't hate anybody. Hating people is no good for you. It will make you sick. Nah, this is the bad things, so let them go. So he told me this story when I was a child and I was whinging about school and I didn't want to go. So I hated the teacher, I hated the school bus driver, I hated the kids on the bus and I hated all the kids at school. And he told me this story again to try and get the point across. You know, you don't hate people. You mustn't do that. It's bad. It'll make you sick. You don't want to get sick, do you? Not to say no. And so when I read this story and I reflected on it, this was what's coming out from my participants. They were saying that all of these adversities and that they'd faced, like racism and the colonialism, were things that they were holding on to. But what they had done, they'd had actually let them go. And this is something that's happened, I guess, throughout the world. These two men here is Mandela and Clinton. And Bill Clinton said to Mandela, he said, years ago I asked him this about the day of his release. He said, you're a great man, you invited your jailers to your inauguration. But tell me the truth, weren't you really angry all over again? And he said, yes, I was angry and I was a little afraid. But when I felt that anger well up inside of me, I realised that if I hated them after I got outside that gate, then they would still have me. And he smiled and said, I wanted to be free. So I let it go. It was an astonishing moment in my life. It changed me, said Bill Clinton. So it's something that's been around for a long time about the need to forgive and move on and the need to start healing. And this is what came through with my research when I questioned Aboriginal people who had been through so much. And they mentioned the two adversities in one way or another. But to reach the point where they were today when I interviewed them as a resilient Aboriginal person, thriving in quite a dominant culture, doing very, very well, that's what they had done. They had forgiven the past, forgiven what had happened. They were no longer a victim, saying, why me, and our land was taken, and this happened to us, and all the negatives that come with that. They had forgiven for that. And therefore, because they'd forgiven, that started the healing process. So for these people, that meant that they could move forward and get on with their life. So they could also live as an Aboriginal person and hold on to the cultural practices and values that they still had, but also thrive in white society. And so this was the answer that I had for people who say to me, well, why are you able to hold down a job and still be at that job? Why can you do it and others can't? So I guess my answer was because I've learnt to forgive for the past. And I guess my parents and my brothers and sisters, my whole family, uncles and aunts, all had a part of that. They helped me do that. And that healing is what actually helps people to move on. And a lot of Aboriginal people today, unfortunately, have not forgiven. They are still the victim. And they find it very, very hard to even work in amongst non-Aboriginal people because they are still holding on to the past things that had happened to them. They haven't forgiven and they haven't started healing. And so that's what I say now, and because I still get asked that question. Why have you made it, believe it or not? You're working at a university and you'll have students saying, well, how come you're here? And other Aboriginal people, you know, some of them just don't, can't do it. So that's what I say to people. That's why it has been possible. And just going back to the lady who had cancer, I wasn't able to tell her story before this, so you'll be the first group to get to hear her story. But I did get permission. She gave me permission. And she had cancer, but her story was an amazing story. She had been put in a mission, and She was removed from her family when she was at the age of 8, taken and put in the Moore River Native Settlement. She learnt to become a domestic, you know, she actually cleaned and cooked, and she was sent out at the age of 14 to a station where she was raped repeatedly, and because she fell pregnant, and she went back to Moore River where she had her baby when she just turned 15. And of course they took her baby and put it in Sister Kate's, because the father obviously was a non-Aboriginal, it was a white man, so that's what happened to children who had white fathers. And then they sent her back to the same station, where again she was repeatedly raped, and again she fell pregnant. So she went back to Moore River and had her baby just after she turned 16. They took the baby again to Sister Kate's, and a third time she was sent back to that same station. And of course, what happens? But the same thing. So on having her third child back at Moore River, begging him not to send her back there to the same station, she had this third child taken from her, and she stayed at Moore River, and they decided to send her to somewhere else. But she had three children, as she said to me, I had three children when I was 18. She ended up getting married and had another family, another three or four children I think she had. Her marriage didn't last. She turned to alcohol because she just didn't deal with what happened to her. So she turned to drink and drugs. She never ever found her three children that were removed. And I guess that's one of the things that kept her drinking. And then she said to me, one day I just woke up and thought, I can't keep going. I've got to do something. So she made the first try at trying to sort her alcohol problems out. But she couldn't do it on her own. And she ended up hitting rock bottom and ending up going to jail for wounding somebody, stabbing, I think it was, and she could do it when she was in jail. She started to really look at herself and met people who offered her a program. And when I interviewed her, she'd been, you know, sober for 20 years. And she said, you know, I said to her, well, what about what happened? And she said, I've forgiven them. I forgave the missionaries. I forgave the men on the station. I've forgiven people. She said, I had to forgive them, and I had to forgive the people who gave my babies away. I have to accept that I'll never see my children. She said, I might, but I don't think so. And she said, then I could start the healing process. And I sat in amazement thinking, wow, it's you know, it was the story that came out that was so vivid for me, to think that somebody could forgive for what had happened to them. And here she was, this very strong, resilient woman. And that certainly made me sit up and think, well, you know, it is the ability to forgive and also start the healing. And I think the thing that really, I guess, came out also is that my dad always knew the answer, but I had to go and do a PhD to find it. Because he did say in his dreaming story, you must forgive. You know, you've got to forgive and let it go. So that's my research. Thank you. Do I have time for questions? Or?
Oh, yes. Sorry,
do you... Any questions? I've answered them all. Oh. I've got two. One. Oh.
Can we get a copy of your
I'm actually, by all means, if you want to get a copy of this presentation, you can. But this has got to go further. I'm looking at once it's submitted. And because I've had a lot of the issues with the methods and trying to get it the Western way, because it's all new stuff. I'm looking at getting it published, yep. But you can certainly get a copy of this. Yes?
Thanks for that. That was great. Just hearing all these stories too, how did you cope with hearing some very powerful? What kind of healing did you go through?
Well, I guess for me it was, I ensured with my ethics, because you have to do that with ethics, I had counselling available for all participants. Many of them did seek counselling because a lot of them didn't have counselling. And I went to counselling too. I mean, you just had to. It was really, they're telling me my story and I'm there crying. You know, it's just really very, very sad. So I did go to counselling as well because I needed to, and debrief, because some of these stories, I mean, you know, that one that I gave was one. And there were others. There were others, you know, in different ways that were quite strong and very intense as well. Yep.
Do you know of anyone yourself that has forgiven, and yet in both Aboriginal culture and looking at it from a Western point of view, has succeeded without forgiving?
No. I know lots of Aboriginal people who I've worked with over the years, and you know the ones who just have not been able to forgive. They are working, but you couldn't really say they're successful. They might be able to go to work every day, but yeah, that they find issues with their identity. There's a victim as well. That's right.
Yeah, I think sometimes some people would actually take much longer as well in their lifespan to work out things. And it depends on what's going on with them individually in reference to their health. You know, like you said, with alcoholism and drug addiction and what have you as well.
Yeah. And some people aren't, you know, I've met the people who are ready to start healing. And
some people
start,
are just not ready. Yeah.
And they'll start, then they stop and it goes back to I'm the victim again. And then they might start again. And then there's other people, you know, I look at them and I don't think that some people just can't. They're just not ready to. I've seen people start at a very late life, you know, age in life. They've gone right through life. But, yeah, it comes back to the individual. Some can start straight away. Some can start years after. It is different stages of people's lives that they're going through. Mm. Well, that's the organisation I used. And I used it because Aboriginal people can just walk off the street and sit and wait for an appointment. You don't have to make appointments. You can just go in. And that's what I found easy. I'd take a lot of the people that I spoke to here. I would take, you know, I took about probably four people because I needed transport and just to go with them to the support. So Yorgun was the organisation I used. There was a couple of people who said, look, I'll find someone else, and we did. And that was their choice. Yeah, but Yorgun was what I used.
I think we have to leave it there, guys. Yeah, start with that, yeah.
Thank you, Marion. I'm sure you've... I'm sure you've got many other questions, so by all means, catch up with Marion maybe in afternoon tea.